talk on the five fears is the fear of being known. The fear of being known. Just to start off with, I'd like to... This is a cartoon from the New Yorker, and these cartoons are usually a little more subtle in their humor. But in any case, it's a psychiatrist consulting with Snoopy. And Snoopy, underneath, says in the caption, "I can smell my own fear." And so fear is something that we need to become very aware of in all the senses, although smell may not be one of them. Certainly physical sensation and mental state of fear needs to be completely opened to in the practice. I was looking also at the New York Times, or somebody I think brought this in, and it was talking about how experts are trying to fix phobias, particularly in this article, children's phobias. And it said they're using a version of what's called traditional exposure therapy. Now, I thought that was interesting. But in this particular type of therapy, the people with phobias are exposed to their worst nightmares until their bodies are too wary to respond with stress. So it beats it out of you. So what, if you think about it, it has a corresponding dharma point there. And that is that at some point, the mind must realize that whatever the exposure of the fear is, it's not going to lay claim to the same dread that we had going in, because we're right there in the middle of it and the dreadful thing is not happening. And at some point, after so long, the mind gives up its fear response because it realizes that it's not true. Do you see? I'm not suggesting that we necessarily, you know, fit ourselves into the closed places of our fear. But through exposure to fear, it does have an eroding effect if we keep challenging it in the exposure to it. If we're afraid of spiders, and whatever we dread from being close to a spider does not occur again and again and again, and if we can just hold ourselves in that steadiness, then the fear can't withstand the truth. It has to release itself. It has to relinquish its projected truth, because the real truth is not substantiating it. You see? So, anyway, it's just... I thought that was an interesting twist. We expose them to the fear and help them realize that what they dread will happen does not truly happen. So, tonight, again, we're going to talk about the fear of being known. Fear of being known. Now, as we venture into these different expressions of fear, remember that each fear is composed of the same elements. They just take on a different characterization depending upon what the content of that fear might be. But if we get a deep, abiding understanding of what fear in its essence is, that it is carried by thought. It's carried by thought. And to let the thought go is ultimately to release ourselves from what the mind's translation or interpretation of a situation might be. And we do that, and we fall into the situation as it's being experienced, rather than to the one that contains the conclusion of where this experience might be going. The problem is to let go of the thought is to let go of the fear thought is to let go of ourselves. So we are hesitant to do that. To let go of the fear thought is to let go of the person being afraid. And most of us would just as soon have the person being afraid, even if we have to be afraid to be that person. We'll accept the fears if it means being embodied. And so we will live a life of fear. There is no question that we will be condemned, is a word that comes to mind, to a life of fear, no matter how much we work to adapt to our fears. And we can do that. You can work to adapt to your fears. You can work in different kind of cognitive therapies or whatever therapies you might enjoy, and mold and like you would with clay to the different circumstances. And what you were afraid of once, like public speaking, you may not be afraid of at some point of time. But fear persists. It just takes on different manifestations. And it will, as long as we keep embodying ourselves. Because the very act of separating ourselves from life, by its very nature, by its definition, is that we do this, the embodiment takes place from self-protection, which is resistance and fear. So as long as we want to be embodied, we're going to have to face this thing. Now, as these talks, we begin to march ourselves through these talks, we will look at the different ways that fear expresses itself. Hopefully, what we will do, if I can connect with your big fear, which one of these five fears is bound to be, then with enough exploration, not to try to adapt ourselves and just to get over that fear so that we can get on with our life. And I mean, that's useful, and it's, you know, it's sort of fender repair. But to really get a basis of how it is that we maintain fear through the way we demand the world to be objectively distant from ourselves, holding it at arm's length. So this particular talk tonight is one of those expressions. It's an interesting one. The fear of being known. Actually, how it was, when I came upon the literature of the five fears in Buddhism, it was the fear of speaking before an assembly. But then I started thinking about, what does that mean, speaking before an assembly? It means the fear of being seen, of being known, doesn't it? One of my early childhood fears was having to answer questions in class and being called upon. And that translated to an enormous fear of public speaking. And which I've relaxed to over the years, but it wasn't with a great deal of adaptation that fear relinquished its hold on me. Why? Because there was an abiding sense of some sense of inadequacy that I didn't want anyone to see. And when you expose yourself publicly, or may I say in intimacy, which is the same fear. The fear of intimacy is the same fear we're talking about. Then you have to expose those parts of yourself that even I am afraid of looking at, or you are afraid of looking at. So that it's the intrapersonal fear that we are afraid of interpersonally, other people seeing. I mean, if I can't look at it myself, I'm certainly not going to get up here and demonstrate something where you can see it. Do you see? It's interesting. You ever noticed, you know, the fear of being seen, the fear of being known? Why is it that we, many of us, back support the little guy in the film? We pull for the little guy in the movies. Because that little guy's us, the one that's being downtrodden and unnoticed, you know, the one that's second best. And we want him to stand up and, you know, because oftentimes who we characterize ourselves to be is that little guy. Not worth noticing. And we hold that a sense of basically, we feel that there's something wrong inside of ourselves. And that we're not willing to risk exposing that flaw, as we translate it, because our self-esteem is at base here, is going to be exposed along with it. And we hold that there's some flawed part of ourselves. We're almost beyond redemption. It's just, I mean, we know it. And there's this very, encrusted fear around it to retain its place within us. And if we ever released it, I mean, we hear the words, just allow, accept, relax, let it be, but not this. Not the core issue in our life, right? Not the core issue. Because that's beyond redemption. Or so we feel. And we feel like there's demons that lurk there. There are demons. I mean, you know, on my unconscious, God knows what's in that. And all of the barbaric and untamed or wild or cruel components of me. In traditional Freudian analysis, it's called the id, that part of ourselves that's a raw, animal-like behavior. And as the practice begins to infiltrate the unconscious, which it does, making the unconscious, which was unconscious, more conscious, there plays across the line then some of the archetypical, often violent images that were being held, which confirms we're unredeemable. Doesn't confirm anything. Doesn't confirm anything. We won't leave ourselves alone. We don't leave ourselves alone. We won't really, truly face that. And so we want that to be hidden to ourselves, and we want that to be hidden to the light of other people's scrutiny. And we're afraid, since the more pressure, the more effort we extend to keep it at bay in our own psyche, the more obvious it is, this is the logic, it is when we start publicly or interpersonally speaking together, how obvious that trait must be to others. And it's a fear of being known, the fear of non-acceptance in ourselves, the fear of that aspect of our being having no place in us. It has no place in me. The problem is that everything is there in all of us. You're nothing special. I don't care what you're seeing or feeling in yourself, nor am I. We all contain the whole range of human consciousness. That's a given for our species. Content differs, but not the range. Haven't we all felt passion? Haven't we all felt lust? Haven't we all felt violence? Haven't we all felt sadness and grief and the whole range? But there's some area there that most of us have that depicts part of that range as completely unacceptable. And it is there that we refuse to be seen, either by ourselves or others. There's also kind of a benefit and not exposing ourselves, because we remain an enigma, mysterious. When we remain unformed from somebody else's perception, we can be anybody. We can play out, we can pretend, can't we? Huh. It's our one chance to be on stage without blemishes in the other person's eye, as long as I don't expose myself for too long or too intimately, because then the fear arises that they'll see through my pretense to the actual embodiment of who I think I am and fear to be. I remember a song in the 60s that went, if only you knew what was inside of me now, you wouldn't want to know me somehow. That feeling of unworthiness, or in the words of fear, perhaps cowardice. And again, the fear of intimacy comes into play, because whether I'm in a group, public speaking, or whether I'm intimate with someone else, that fear of being known comes through intimacy, fear of intimacy. And the backlash of that is often multiple relationships of very minor depth and connectedness. See, that's different than shyness. Shyness is not a problem. Shyness can have a fear base to it, but it can also be a kind of a genetic disposition not to particularly like crowds. The preference isn't towards groups. There's nothing wrong with being introverted or extroverted or any combination thereof. It's when that trait becomes laced with fear that the problem resides. Often a very sensitive person has a greater degree of fear because they're fine-tuned to the outward projections of what they think other people are seeing at a much more minuscule level than the people of grosser level of awareness. So how does this fear of being known, what are some of the expressions of it? Public speaking is certainly one of them. But how about speaking out, the unpopular view? Speaking out, taking a stand on something. I saw just the very beginning of an Oprah Winfrey show, and they showed an actual film of kids in a bus. Most of them had left the bus, and one bully got back on the bus and pushed one of the kids and just started beating ruthlessly this smaller child after the bus had been emptied. And there were some other kids on the bus, two or three other people, and they just all stood back, and, you know, I mean, where you see, we get frozen in ourselves, unable to take wise action for fear of risking being seen. That's one aspect. I certainly have my fears, but that's one that doesn't go so... That I'm not intoned with. And I remember stepping into a very vicious fight between two huge adult males, and, you know, just because you can't, at some point, why, how can you not do that? How can you watch people destroy each other? You just, there's something in the heart that just, so, you know, you just take appropriate action, you just do it. And so it's just that fear isn't there. There's no heroics there. But for each of us, taking a stand on, you know, taking a stand, this is our unique time and place in history. Now, are we going to be heard? Or are we going to be mute? And it doesn't mean that, I'm not talking about political volume here. I'm not talking about anything in particular. It's just, see, where are we on that? When you see somebody and they're asking you questions and they're saying things that you don't agree with and you're just nodding your head, you know, it's there. That's the place. That's the place. I remember in Thailand, I couldn't speak Thai, and everybody would come up to me and speak Thai, and I just nod my head because I got tired of saying "my khao jai," which is "I don't understand," and then people would go into all these anecdotes. So I would just, but I felt like an idiot because I had no. Is the risk too great? You see, is our default position to conform? Is that the default position? My teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, was a man who I loved his steadfast. He would not ever compromise the Dharma. Never. And so people would come to him and say, you know, Ajahn, playing up to him and saying, we could build you great buildings and we could expand your temple grounds and, you know, we have the money to do that. And Ajahn Buddhadasa would say, why don't you take your money and throw it off that cliff? And there was this fear of communist overtones. There were always fear of communists in Thailand, and when I was there in particular, because it's neighbors, it neighbored Vietnam, and etc. In any case, Laos. So the people would come all frightened, and they would say to Ajahn Buddhadasa, you know, Ajahn, you know, the communists are gaining ground in Thailand. What are we going to do? And Ajahn Buddhadasa would say, well, we can practice for communists. And people would say that he was making a statement that it was okay to be communist. He wasn't making a statement at all about that. He was, we can practice no matter what happens to us, regardless of conditions. He wasn't making a statement of pro-communism, but he wasn't about to back away and be politically nice. Oh, it would be, no, we can do that. Because at the level of Dharma, the conditions are secondary. What's primary is that it's workable. No matter what. Creaky doors. It's workable. So as our tendency to stay within the known sequencing, it's amazing to me how many people default to that. You know, just stay, don't say anything that can ruffle or create a problem. Now you can go the other way and make that a big role for yourself, where you're just always talking politically, political activism and making a statement of, you know, that your nonconformist is a conformist. They've just accepted their role in conformity as an adversary. I remember back in the 60s, I could never get into the hippie thing, although my politics and philosophy was very in accordance with that, but I just saw them doing the same thing, that they were, the anti-establishment was the establishment for this group of people. There was no independence. There was no autonomy. There was no authenticity. At least how I would have taken it on. So, You just don't. You don't. This group I'm reacting against, so I'll join my... I mean, that doesn't make any sense at some point. That's not authentic. Fear of being authentic. Fear of not conforming. What does it mean to be authentic? You know, we would rather impersonate ourselves than be ourselves. We would rather live according to some kind of ideal. We think that's what authenticity. Authenticity is not living. It's not being authentic to yourself when there isn't one. It's being authentic to reality. Okay, having less, working diligently to release the hold that thought has on us all the time, which is the inauthentic me, and coming more and more deeply into the authentic me of stillness, of quietude. And that constant sense of self-commentary that we have, you know, that is throwing us off base because it perceives other people's reaction as something wrong in oneself. And there's this constant adjusting of our inward position to fit the outward expression of what we think will resonate. And it produces the critic. You know the critic, the commentary, ongoing commentary, the judger. All of that is because we don't want to be seen. We don't think when we're seen, we're thrown back on our doubt. Is there any... I mean, part of doubt is legitimate. We're doubting whether we have anything there that's substantial, and there isn't. But what when it turns into a psychological doubt, there's no firm place to stand. There's no body reference. There's no groundedness. It's just looking in someone else's eyes and then changing positions to what I think their expectations are. And may I say that the groundedness of the body, going into the body, is the first real refuge for fear, for us to be able to get a handle on fear, feeling the groundedness. Okay, here, as the poem said, be a person here. Be a person here. Okay. Now another expression of this fear of being known is stage fright or writer's block. When the lamp of other people's attention is upon us, we can become so self-absorbed, can't we? That it freezes us up. It freezes our inhibitions. Freeze our fluidity. There's no fluidity. Creativity requires ease of well-being. And with that inward pressure. And this, again, the self-doubt saying, oh, you don't really have anything to say. Not of any substance. Or that sense of being phony. And you just freeze up. You freeze up. You can't paint. You can't write. No creativity comes. No new ideas. Why? Because there's a fear of being known. And you can just see the whole, it's just like a log jam. Log jam of the spirit. And another expression, or you're just looking at different expressions of what, how this fear of being known takes different manifestations. How about the fear of being ordinary? We're afraid if we, some of us are afraid if we expose ourselves, what people will see is just somebody who's ordinary. And in this culture, that's a sin. We think of ordinary as being mechanical or rote, sameness. And we're supposed to be the best. Not ordinary. Not ordinary. And that ordinary is actually a sense of deprivation. But can I, let us just look. Dharma is being ordinary. Nothing special. Nothing special. Why beat the breasts of a ghost? Unless you're Janet Jackson. How about just being ordinary? Not to try to be anything other than just that. Humility. Just what we say, just what we do. My position in this organization, you would think, would be, okay, well, I'm speaking and people are listening. And just ordinary. It's a role. Somebody that works the tables has a role. I have a role. Nothing that one does in any way can be translated out of the ordinary. Other than that. Certain skills, great. Some people feel so deprived of love that though they seek attention through their actions. The person who's always contrary is really attention starved and confuses love for attention. Such a person wants to be looked at outside but not inside. Don't look too deep. Notice me, please, so that I'm not just ordinary, so that I'm more than that. But don't look inside, because inside there's a vulnerability and a fragility that if you look too deep, the person will just... But their whole life is about gaining attention, standing ahead of the crowd, to be noticed. And everybody knows people like that. The fear of being known defines us more by what we do not allow, that we do not do. Holding ourselves back. Somebody who is afraid to be known is often over-prepared, is so organized, so detailed, so consistent. Mistakes are not acceptable. Because to see a flaw represents their flaw, the internal flaw. the issue that they're trying to protect through their organization. That's why someone said consistency is the hobnob of the small mind. Life has nothing to do with consistency. Or over-prepared, that every possible mistake, every implication must be considered and weighed. Which leads, of course, to extended worry and planning. Why? So that they won't be seen. So that the root pain will not be pierced, will not be observed. And is there any wonder that there can be a pervasive anxiety? We don't know what we're afraid of, but we wake up in the morning and we're afraid because we're hiding the pain that we don't want anyone to observe, including us. So there's this anxiety and we don't even know where it's located. But it's in everything we do and every action we take in order to protect people from seeing that which we are most afraid of. And we don't even know what it is. We just have a sense that it's there. In every contact, in every action, in every behavior. Am I doing something wrong? And it's pervasive. What about if we went to the pain? What if we went the other way on this issue? What if he said, wait a minute, this is insanity. I'm being driven insane. Let's go the other way here. What is this pain? What is this fear? What is it going to do? What's a feeling going to do? It's going to make us feel it. Okay. And it's through our willingness to see it that the ownership that we so dread having is actually relinquished. Because you see, it's just circumstance. It's just weather. It's just the coming and going of this or that. It doesn't define me. We're so afraid of it popping up. Even when it's not there, we're in fear of it. We think it's constant. Nothing's constant. We think it's always right behind the scenes, acting up. Never. No. False. False. Nothing is. Nothing is constant. And then there may be a moment of respite when we actually don't feel it. And we don't give ourselves credit for having an embodiment of that moment in which we're not afraid. We're so used to being afraid that that's just a gap between two places of fear. Temporary. And we fill the gap in to be continuously fearful. But it's not true. Have you ever noticed that when you're not dwelling on your problems, they don't exist? It's not that they're really somewhere else. They don't exist. Dwell and they exist. Don't dwell and they don't exist. You exist. Existence continues. And there's this moment of spaciousness where you're relieved and you might be happy. And then, oh my God, I forgot what I... And then it exists again. And we keep defining ourselves by the presence of the problem and never fully verifying, accepting, allowing the fact that there are many times that the way out of it is shown to us multiple times throughout the day. Don't dwell. We like dwelling because we like being fearful and resistant to life. I've got a struggle. We're ennobled by it. I've got tasks to do. We have this sense of ourselves, of being ennobled through struggle. Like tempered steel, you know, it has to go through the hottest fires. Well, I kind of like the silence between those states. And your heart starts looking at that. There's a possibility there. In our life, no matter what our life is like, there are those times when we're focused on something, when we're interested in something, when our heart is totally engaged, when there's existence in its fullness of embodiment of life, of vitality, of awakefulness. Why do we have to bring anything on top of that to struggle with? Why do we need that? What does that add? And can we look at those challenges in life, because challenges do arrive, from that same degree of interest and openness, rather than as some indication of what I contain, something that I need to protect myself so that people don't see me? I'm not up to this problem. Oh my God, throwing the casting. I don't care. Okay, this is it. Come what may. That's the spirit of the Dharma. But we have to be so sick of the hiding. Come what may. Seeking. Nope. Come what may. See. Bad mood, good mood, sun face moon, sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha. Everyone. And so we can relax, looking at the fear, seeing how it's just thought induced, more problem induced. It's not here. Be a person here. It's not here. It's not here. But you don't understand, it's going to be. No. You don't understand. It's not here. Then we'll know the end of fear. Can we sit for a minute or two?